Okay, so as we introduce our topic this morning, I'd like to ask for your help. And I want to begin by thinking about Saul. Okay, Saul before he becomes Paul. And I want you to think about Acts chapter 9 and what we know about Saul before Acts chapter 9. What do we know about his life? What do we know about his background? What information do we have about Saul?
He was a Pharisee.
He was a Pharisee. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
He was persecuting Christians.
Okay. All right. There's a lot to unpack there in that. All right. So the first thing we know about Saul, he was a Pharisee. He was from the tribe of Benjamin. He grew up and he studied under Gamaliel. Gamaliel was the most famous rabbi of the day, okay, and he refers to himself. He talks about his religious background, and how does he describe himself when he talks about his background? And think about in Acts chapter 23, Acts 26, when he's referring to himself, what's he say about his religious background? Pharisee among Pharisee, Jew among Jew, okay. He refers to himself as being extremely zealous, right? That he advanced in Judaism. In Galatians chapter 1, he says, I advanced in Judaism beyond my contemporaries. Okay, so we have the picture of someone who was a very devout Pharisee, a very strict Pharisee. He says he followed the traditions of their fathers in the strictest sense. Okay, he studied under Gamaliel. Again, the most famous rabbi of the day. What else do we know about Gamaliel, by the way? He was a well-respected teacher. Anything else we know about him? So in Acts chapter 5, when Peter and John are arrested and they're brought before the Sanhedrin, who speaks up for leniency on their behalf? It's Gamaliel, right? So he was a member of the Sanhedrin. Okay, and well respected. The other point was he persecuted Christians. Okay, he persecuted the saints. We'll come back to that in a moment. What else do we know about him? He was from Tarsus. Yep, born in Tarsus. He was a Roman citizen. Okay. When do we learn he's a Roman citizen? Okay, so he's arrested and he says to the centurion, is it proper the way you're treating me? How do you become a Roman citizen? He was born a Roman citizen. There's three ways you could become a Roman citizen. You'd be born as a Roman citizen, you could purchase your citizenship, or you could be granted citizenship because of the service that you provided to the government. Okay. Anything else? When are we first introduced to Saul? All right. So in Acts chapter 7, we read about Stephen, and they decide to take Stephen out of the city, and they're going to stone Stephen. And they take their outer garments off, and who do they give them to? They give them to Saul. Okay, and I remember studying Stephen as a kid, studying that story and reading through it, and I kind of stopped at the end of chapter seven, and I always kind of asked myself, well, I wonder what he thought. I wonder what was going through his mind. I wonder if he was shocked by it. I wonder if it bothered him. I wonder, you know, how he felt about it. This is when chapter divisions aren't very helpful, because what's it say in Acts chapter 8, verse 1 about Saul? I sort of hear it, but I can't make it out. Saul signed off on it. It says he was consenting to his death. Okay? So Saul was fine with what happened to Stephen. Okay, And so in Acts chapter 8, it says he consented to his death. In Acts chapter 8, verses 3, let's get into what Saul was doing in terms of persecution. In Acts chapter 8, verse 3, it says, "As for Saul, he made havoc of the church, entering every house and dragging off men and women, committing them to prison." Okay, flip over to Acts chapter 9, verse 1. "Then Saul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priests, and he asked for letters from them so that he could go to Damascus, to the synagogues in Damascus, so that if he found anyone who were of the way, whether men or women, he might bring them bound for Jerusalem." What was Ananias' reaction when Jesus told him to go see Saul? Yeah, are you kidding me? All right, I don't want to go do that. Why did he not want to go do that? Well, reputation, okay. Was what Saul was doing, was it sort of, you know, did a few people know about it? Everyone knew about it, okay? He was, all that zeal that he had for his religion, all that zeal and how active he was in being a Pharisee, he took to this persecution. Okay, so, you know, Saul, Ananias says in verse 13, "I've heard of the many about this man, how much harm he's doing to your saints in Jerusalem, that he has the authority of the chief priest to bind, to put in prison all those who call on your name." After Saul is converted and is baptized, in verse 20, it says that he began to preach in the synagogues. What was everyone's reaction when he began to preach in the synagogues? What's it say in verse 21? They're all shocked at what they're seeing, right? They don't understand it because his reputation preceded him. Okay, he was someone that they knew was out to try to destroy all the saints. They knew that he had gone to the high priest to get permission to imprison people. Okay, I think it's interesting. Flip over to Acts 26. When he talks about himself in front of King Agrippa. In verse 5, we've already mentioned this. He talks about the fact that he was a Pharisee according to the strictest sect of the religion. And then listen to how he describes himself and the life he was living, beginning in verse 9. He said, "Indeed, I myself thought I must do many things contrary to the name of Jesus of Nazareth. This I also did in Jerusalem, and many of the saints I shut up in prison, having received authority from the chief priests." Verse 11, "And I punished them often in every synagogue and compelled them to blaspheme. And being exceedingly enraged against them, I persecuted them even to foreign cities." All right. Verse 10, end of verse 10, I skipped that. "When they were put to death, I cast my vote against them." All right, and some have read that and suggested perhaps Saul himself was a member of the Sanhedrin, you know, the Jewish council, and they would vote on matters, they put pebbles to vote on matters, and some have suggested, well, that indicates that he was a member of the Sanhedrin, and when it came time to decide whether they were going to try to put saints to death, he was casting his vote. We're not sure. It doesn't really matter either. It could mean that he was just endorsed the decision. Either way, we have the picture of someone who was extremely active at persecuting the church. Okay, how do we remember Paul? Is that the person we remember? All right, who's the person we remember? All right, missionary. Yeah. So, you know, he's on his way to Damascus. He's received the permission from the high priest to go to Damascus to arrest the saints. And he's on his way, and he's stopped on the road to Damascus by Jesus. He's blind, can't see. And then Ananias goes to him and he's baptized. Okay? And then he becomes a missionary. What else do we think about Paul when we think about Paul and not Saul? What do we think about? I'm sorry? Okay. All right. So he went from being the one that did all the persecuting to being the one that what? Was persecuted. All right. Was he persecuted just a little? Go to 2 Corinthians chapter 11. So obviously in Acts, when we study about his missionary journeys, we hear him talk about being jailed. We hear him talk about being being beaten. But in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, these are his words. From the Jews, 5 times I received 40 stripes minus one. How many is that? Yeah, okay. 195 stripes if my math's working this morning. Okay, 195 times. All right, 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. At night and a day I've been in the deep, in journeys often, in perils in the water, in perils of robbers, in perils of my own countrymen, perils of Gentiles, in perils in the city, perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren, in weariness and toil, and sleepless often, in hunger and thirst, in fasting often, in cold and nakedness. So we have someone who went from severely persecuting the saints to being the one being persecuted. That's the Paul we think about. What else do we think about when we think about Paul? The missionary journeys, the persecution he endured. What else? I'm sorry? A writer. Okay. How many letters in our New Testament did Paul pen? 13. 12 for sure. There we go. All right. 12 for sure, maybe 13. Okay. How many books do we have in the New Testament? Okay. So how many of them did he write? All right, more than anyone, right? Okay. That's who we think about. What happened when Paul and Peter interacted in Galatians? What did Paul do? I'm sorry? He confronted him. Okay. What happened with Peter? Peter was eating with Gentiles, and then when the... Yeah, all right, so he was acting like a hypocrite, wasn't, he was with the Gentiles, but when the Jews came, he quit interacting with the Gentiles, so Paul confronted him about it, okay? Now, I know you know all that, so why are we taking the time to talk about it? I want you to think about the way Paul described himself in his letters and how he talked about his life. Okay, flip over to 1 Corinthians chapter 15. You know, sometimes... we'll have this happens at work for me. Individuals retire, and when individuals retire, we have celebrations to get everyone together that they've worked with and kind of celebrate their careers. And everyone comes and says nice things about them, and someone gets in front of the group that's there, and what do? They start listing what? All their accomplishments, all the things that they have done that's been great, all the reasons why we should thank this person. This is how Paul described himself in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. After he talks about the fact that Jesus, according to the scriptures, died on the cross, he was buried, he was raised from the dead, he was seen by Peter first, then by the 12, then 500 brethren, he was seen by James and the other apostles, and then him. And then this is how he describes himself in verse 9. For I am the least of the apostles, who am not worthy to be called an apostle, because I persecuted the church of God. In Ephesians chapter 3, verses 8, he says, I am less than the least of all the saints. In Romans chapter 1, he refers to himself as being a debtor. And in 1 Timothy 1, chapter 15, he says, Jesus Christ came into the world to save sinners, of whom, what? I am chief. That's how Paul talked about himself. He didn't talk about all his missionary journeys. He didn't talk about all the persecution he endured. He didn't talk about how he taught the gospel to so many people. He talked about the fact that he was the least of all the apostles, less than the least of all the saints, that he was a debtor, that he was a chief sinner. What is that? What's the word?
Humility.
Humility. So I want us to talk about humility this morning. Thank you for being patient with me on a rather long introduction, longer than I thought it was going to be. Okay, so humility. Okay, let me ask you another question. Let's shift gears a little bit. I want you to think about Jesus and his disciples. And I want you to think about the time that they spent together. And answer this question for me. Do you believe the disciples got it? Did they understand everything Jesus was teaching them? I see a lot of heads saying no. Here's some no's. Why? What makes you say that? Didn't get it till after his resurrection. They're still expecting an earthly kingdom. What else? Yep. We're gonna hit on all these. What, anything else? Right, exactly. Okay. So couple of times where I think we can look at it and say they didn't get it. So there were times where Jesus was with them, right, and he would foretell his death. It happens in Mark chapter 9, Luke chapter 9, Luke 18. He says to him, let me just go over here real quick. Luke 18. Okay. He took the 12 aside, and this is kind of how it happens in the different accounts in Mark 9, Luke 9, Luke 18. He takes the disciples aside, and in Luke's account, it's they're all similar, but in Luke's account, he says, "Behold, we're going up to Jerusalem, and all the things that are written by the prophets concerning the Son of Man will be accomplished, for he will be delivered to the Gentiles and will be mocked and insulted and spit upon. They will scourge him and kill him, and the third day he will rise again." Verse 34, but they understood none of these things. They didn't get it. Okay. Someone, and I'm sorry, I forgot who it was, mentioned that they were expecting an earthly kingdom. What happened after Jesus is raised from the dead? Some of them are still in disbelief. In Mark 16, he says, he confronts them about still being in unbelief. In John 20, who is it that specifically says, let me see your hands? Thomas. Okay. All right, so when you study and spend time looking at Jesus after he's been raised from the dead, and he's with the apostles, you look at Matthew 28, you look in Luke 24, you look at Mark 16, John 20, and you see all these mentions of the interactions Jesus had with the apostles. It's also important to go to Acts 1, because remember, Luke also wrote Acts, and he really kind of shares the same information, but gives you a little bit more detail in Acts chapter 1. In Acts chapter 1, when they're all there with him, and this is before he heads up to... Before he ascends to heaven, he's with them. He commands them not to leave Jerusalem. He tells them to wait for the promise of the Father. A few of you have mentioned that before. It's Helper, or the Spirit is coming. And then this is what they say. So he's with them. He's been raised from the dead. And this is what they ask him. Verse 6. Lord, will you at this time restore the kingdom of Israel? Okay. So even then, they still didn't fully get it. All right. Now, let me digress a little bit here, because the point's been made and it's important. And I think we all realize it and understand it. They didn't fully understand, but as been mentioned in Acts chapter 2, the helper arrives. You go back to John 15, John 16. Jesus promises them the helper. He tells them they're going to be a witness for him. Luke 24, Acts 1, he tells them to stay in Jerusalem, that the helper's coming. In Acts 2, the helper arrives. They're filled with the Holy Spirit, and then they go and preach the gospel. Okay? And at that point, they get it. All right. So we're a little hard on them sometimes. We've seen a few examples of when they just didn't get it. There's another time where I think they just didn't get it. There's another time where, you know, Jesus must have just been shaking his head. And it happens a couple times when they're with Jesus. And they get into what the Bible refers to as a dispute. What's the dispute? Does anyone remember? What's the dispute the disciples get into a few times? I'm sorry? Who's the greatest? Okay. So they get into this dispute in Matthew 18. James and John, you know, they come to Jesus, and what do they ask for? Can one of us be on your left and one of us be on your right? So they get into this dispute. In Mark chapter 9, it talks about the dispute. In Luke chapter 9, it talks the dispute. And what's one of the things Jesus tells them or does when they get into this dispute? Anyone remember? I'm sorry? It's not mine to give. Go to Luke chapter 9 real quick. Verse 46. And Jesus, verse 46. Then a dispute arose among them as to which would be the greatest. And Jesus, perceiving the thought of their heart, took a little child and set it before him and said, "Whoever receives this little child in my name receives me. Whoever receives me receives him who sent me. For he who is the least among you will be the great, will be great." What were, at that time, what kind of status did children have? Very low. So he puts a child in front of them, and same thing in Matthew's account, puts a child in front of them and says, "You need to be like this child." Okay? In Mark chapter 9, he responds by telling them that that they need to, if they desire to be first, then they need to be last of all and servant of all. When was the last time that dispute arose? Does anyone remember? Okay. So go to Luke 22. The last time this dispute arises is when Jesus is with them and he's instituted the Lord's Supper. I want you to think about that for a moment. Okay? He is soon going to be arrested. He's going to be tried. He's going to go be crucified on the cross. He's with the disciples here at the end. And they get into this dispute again. Who's the greatest? So in Luke 22, verse 24, "Now there was also a dispute among them as to which of them should be the greatest." What does Jesus do? How does he answer this? And it's not in Luke. All right. John 13. Flip over there. So I want you to think about the fact that this is the last thing he teaches them before he's arrested and is crucified. So he's with the disciples, instituted the Lord's Supper. They get into this debate again, this dispute again about who's the greatest. And so Jesus washes their feet. Okay. How many, when they were in this upper room, how many people were in the upper room with them? Was it a party? It was just them. Okay? There was no host. There was no servants. Typically, in that time, when you would go into a house, what would happen before you entered the house or as you were entering the house? All right. So they had sandals that protected their feet when they walked, but it wasn't there to keep their feet clean. All right. Their feet were dirty. Feet were dusty. And so the first thing that would happen when you would enter a house is the host would typically have a servant who would wash your feet. Okay. It was just Jesus and the disciples when they were in the upper room. There was no host. There was no one there to wash their feet. So Jesus takes this opportunity when the disciples have, you know, once again sort of not gotten it, who've gotten into this dispute again after Jesus has corrected them a number of times and taught them a number of times and try to change their thinking. He gives them an example. Okay? And so in verse 4, he lays aside his garment, he takes the towel, and after that he poured water into the basin and he began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe with the towel in which he was girded. Did he wash a few of their feet? All their feet. Including whose? Judas. Okay? So he gives them this example, and then he talks about it. He explains it. In verse 12, when he had washed their feet, taken his garments, he sat down again and he said to them, Do you know what I have done? Do you understand it? Do you get why I just did this? Verse 13. Who was the greatest among them? Jesus. All right? He refers to himself in verse 13, you call me teacher and you call me Lord. In verse 14, if I then am your Lord, if I then am your teacher, and I've washed your feet, what should you do? Wash one another's feet. You think they thought about this after Jesus was gone? You think they thought about, looked back with a little bit of regret, realizing that the last time they spent with him, they were getting into a debate on who was the greatest? You think that was a powerful teaching moment for them? You think that changed the way they interacted with others and the way they taught the gospel? So in verse 15, he says, I've given you an example. You should do as I have done. Was he telling them that they need to go into everyone's house and wash everyone's feet? Is that the point? What was the point? You got to serve. He wants you to serve. Okay. Is that what Paul did? Did Paul serve? Okay. How do you serve? If you're going to serve, what do you need? Humility. You need humility. Hey, flip over to Philippians chapter 2. Okay. So context is important here. Philippians chapter 2, verses 1 through 11 are verses we all need to know. They're important verses, and it's important for us to know what Paul was saying here. Let's talk about a little bit of context. So Paul is writing to the church at Philippi, and in verse 27, he says, "Only let your conduct be worthy of the gospel, so that whether I come and see you or am absent, I may hear of your affairs, that you stand fast in one spirit, with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel. What's he talking about? What's he asking them to have? Unity. Okay? So he's encouraging them to remain faithful. He's encouraging them to have unity. Okay? That's the context. And then, so let's look at chapter 2, verse 1. Therefore, if there is any consolation in Christ, if any comfort of love, if any fellowship of the Spirit, of any affection and mercy, fulfill my joy by being like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind. Okay? So, what's he talking about? What's he want? Unity. Okay. So, he's writing to the Christians. He's encouraging them to be of the same mind, to have the same love, to be of one accord. How do you do that? How do you have unity? Verse 3. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit. What's that mean? Don't be selfish. Don't put yourself first. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. What's that mean? Esteem others better than himself. Yeah, putting yourself last. Putting others' interest ahead of you. Okay? How do you have unity? How do you be of one mind? How do you be of one accord? By being selfless. By putting the interest and the well-being of your brothers and sisters ahead of your own. Verse 4. Let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but also for the interest of others. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. Okay. So he's told them, he wants them to have unity. The way you have unity is to be selfless. The way you have unity is to put the interest of your brothers and sisters ahead of your own. And now he's going to talk about Jesus. Yep. Harmony. Yeah. In verse 2. Instead of being of one accord, being in harmony. You wrote the word harmony. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Being in harmony with one another. Okay, so let's look verse 5. He starts being in the mind in which you were also in Christ Jesus, who, being in the form of God, did not consider it robbery to be equal with God. What does that mean? He was in the same level of God, but didn't act like it. Was Jesus still God when he came to earth? This can get tricky. All right. Was he still God? He was. Was he still equal to God the Father? He was. All right, so what's this mean? Okay. Sorry, what? Oh. I think about yeah, he was still God. He was still equal to God the Father. But what did he do? He didn't use his power for his own benefit. Okay, so lots of songs come to mind when we start thinking about 10,000 angels. He could have called 10,000 angels, but he didn't. What did he do instead? He took on what? In verse 7. He made himself of no reputation, taking on the form of a bondservant. What did he allow himself to do?
I have written in here that he emptied himself.
He emptied himself. Okay? He emptied himself. All right? And there are versions that refer to that he was being in the form of God, he considered it not robbery to be equal with God, or he emptied himself. Okay? So even though he was God, and even though he was equal to God, he took on human form, and he allowed himself to what?
Be a servant.
Yeah. He allowed himself to be tempted. He allowed himself to endure physical pain. He allowed himself to deal with all the things that we deal with. Okay? What does Paul say that is? In verse 8, and being found in the appearance of as a man, he, Jesus, did what?
Humbled himself.
He humbled himself. All right. And by humbling himself, he became obedient to the point of death, even to the death of the cross. Think to the Garden of Gethsemane. In the Garden of Gethsemane, what was it Jesus prayed? Oh, Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. What did he do? What did Jesus do? Opened himself. He allowed himself to be humble. He allowed himself, which allowed him to be obedient to the will of God, to serve God's plan. That's what he did. And he willingly stayed on the cross.
Submitted to God's plan.
Yes, ma'am. So why is humility important? Why spend this time talking about it this morning? Why we do it? God hates what?
Rebellion.
Rebellion. Yep. I'm sorry.
There's too much of you in front of your face,
there's no God. The problem with pride. Right. So I want you to think about Jesus, these verses. Jesus humbled himself. By humbling himself, he was obedient to the will of God. How do you have unity in the church? By being selfless, by putting the interest of others, of your brothers and sisters, in front of your own. What is that? Humility. Okay. What was the example, the last example Jesus left the disciples before he was arrested? Washing their feet. Being a servant. You can only serve if you're humble. And now you understand a little bit better when Paul was writing on those last days, the heart he had when he referred to himself as the least of all the apostles, less than the least of all the saints, a debtor and a chief sinner. Because Paul lived his life in a way that he realized he was there to serve, and the only way he was able to serve was the humility he had in his heart. Okay. Any closing thoughts? Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really important, something we probably don't spend enough time talking about. Think about in 1 Corinthians 11, we read it a lot up here before the Lord's Supper. For I received from the Lord, which I deliver to you. He wasn't with them in the upper room. So where did he get it? He got it from Jesus. All right, that should tell you how important the Lord's Supper is, where Jesus took the time to tell Paul so that Paul told the Christians. I saw another hand. Yep. Yeah, so for those of you who couldn't hear, the comment was just about the prayer that Stephen gave, asking for God's forgiveness for those who were stoning him, and the impact that may have had on Saul's life when he heard that as well. All right, thank you so much for your kind attention and participation.